Hello everyone, welcome to the library. My name is Jonathan Curtis, I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch. Welcome to today's lecture on notes on migrants and jobs, and we welcome Professor Bob Gregory here to speak to us. You've probably seen the flyer, you're aware of his fairly illustrious and interesting background in the areas of economics, and currently Professor Emeritus at the Research School of Economics in the Australian National University. He's held visiting positions at the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System in Washington, Harvard University, University College London, and a few other places. But I sort of trimmed the large and extensive CV down to manageable proportions for the flyer. But I think Bob's spoken at least once before.
Yes, probably.
Yeah, so it's great to have you back.
Thank you.
And as is the usual course of things, Bob will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have question and answer session, and should have you out by no later than 1:30. So please join me in welcoming Professor Gregory.
Thank you. Thank you for all coming. Sometimes you can get an idea of the talk from the very, very beginning, and this slide will sort of give you a good indication of the talk. I can remember when I was a young person coming across Pirandello's play, Six Characters in Search of an Author, about 50 years ago, and I've never been able to use it in any way, right? Because nobody's ever read the play, as far as I know. But I thought it was rather neat for this because basically I've got all these bits and pieces which I'll show you, which I think are very, very important, like really important, but I'm having trouble putting them all together. And so, to get a nice, clear storyline. And so I've shoved that up as an indication of that fact and prepare you. In fact, this is going to wander around a little bit amongst the six authors. But it even got better because I thought I better check to make sure I had the right title. So I looked up Wikipedia, and it turned out that Pirandello was born in Sicily in a town called Chaos. And I thought that was just so great that I really got to use that. So it'll be a bit chaotic, this talk. But let me tell you why I'm doing it, right? One of the amazing facts is that Australia just got through the GFC basically without blinking. Right? I mean, we really are quite special in that sense. There was sort of a six-month setback, and then it was fixed in some sense. The main thing that fixed it, basically, was the underlying strength of the mining boom, which was evolving at that time, and which is the biggest thing we've seen in Australia for a long, long time, with huge implications. Like today, for example, I was told by a little bird, who I haven't got it accurate, that the GDP figures go up by 3 and the national income figures go down by 2. Now, that split between one and the other is an indication of one of the implications of this mining boom. But as time has gone by, I haven't wavered in the view the mining boom was very, very important. But then I stumbled across another fact, which is basically the fact that I'm going to talk about today, and which is that over this period of time, there's been a remarkable change in our immigration policy, which I think we all sort of know about, but it hasn't registered. And I'll describe now what I mean by this change in the immigration policy. The policy up until, say, a decade and a half ago, say, let's just say up to 2000, none of these dates are accurate because policy keeps shifting and changing, but basically the policy up to that date, which was the policy of my life, is you were sitting in Italy in the 1950s or in the Middle East in the 1980s or somewhere in Asia in the 1990s and said, I want to go to Australia. So you applied for a permanent visa, and the government then looked at you and decided that you could come or not come. And so the result of that was that, and this is a good line, all our immigrants came from overseas. That is, they were sitting in a country, and then we decided whether they should come by applying various things like points tests and so on, right? Then, basically, from the 2000s onwards, more or less, the system sort of changed. And it changed in the way that if you wanted to come to Australia, you could sort of come without a permanent visa. And you could come and you could work without a permanent visa. The degree to which you could work was limited somewhat, but nevertheless you could come. So you didn't have to sit there in, say, Hong Kong and say, I want to come to Australia, let's get a visa. You'd say, oh, I'm going to go to Australia. I'm going to go to Australia. And then you can set it up, basically. You come on a temporary visa. And then you work and you muck around for a while. And then you say, oh, I wouldn't mind staying here. So then you apply for a permanent visa. And the net result of that is all our over 60% of our immigrants now do not come from overseas. That is, 60% of our immigrants come from here. And you can see I'm shifting the definition of immigrants a little bit, right? But by immigrant I mean applying for and getting a permanent visa. So we're now in the situation where 60% of people, of our immigrants, get their visa here. So this is what I call a two-step procedure, or a try before you buy. Now what that means is, in the old system, you know, you're sitting in Italy and you've got to make up your mind whether you want to come or not to get the visa. Then when you get here, if it doesn't turn out, you've got to go home. But now you don't have to do all that. You don't have to sell up and come. You just come, muck around for a while, and see whether you want to stay. Then if you want to stay, you start trying to bring that about. And the government on its side now has sort of changed its rules. It doesn't have to judge what you look like in Italy or Hong Kong or somewhere. It can judge how you look here. So it can say, oh, you've been hanging around for 7 years. What have you been doing? What are you doing now? And so we can say to our immigrants, we will take you, providing you have a job in Australia and are working in Australia. Whereas under the old system, you couldn't do that because you're in Italy. So you can sort of see the two big changes that are going on here. One is the selection procedure has shifted dramatically on our side because we're giving people to come and try it out, then we'll see what happens. And it's shifted dramatically on their side because they can come. Now, how immigration policy is very complicated and it's always changing. So why bother with this? I mean, you know, why bother? Well, we should bother because it's big. And I'll show you how big it is. Roughly speaking, we have 1 million extra people in this country with a permanent visa, more than we expected to have a decade ago. In other words, the people who were thinking about how immigration was going to evolve a decade ago were probably 1 million out. Now, 1 million is a lot of people, right? A lot of people. So that's why it should matter. The second thing why it should matter is that all of a sudden you get this disjunction between the planning levels and the reality. The planning levels revolve around the permanent visas. You know, we will have 190 permanent immigrants next year. But, you know, we may end up with 300,000 because all these other people come in on temporary. We may say we're going to have 190 permanent immigrants, and we give out 190,000 and they come or they stay, but everybody else leaves. So on balance, we may end up with nothing. So the world has changed. So all I'm going to do now is show you some of the implications of that. Now, why would it matter? Well, suppose you were in the housing game and you were a big company projecting the number of houses we needed. Then, in 2005, looking ahead for a decade, suppose of these million people, half of them wanted to buy a house, or two people buy a house, you'd be 500,000 houses out. You'd have a house shortage. If you have a house shortage, prices of houses go up, right? And that's basically what's happened. Then, if the policy changes, then all of a sudden it'll go the other way. So let me show you just some words about some of the things I've said. Namely, that this process of unhooking the people coming here from the permanent visa can be thought of as privatisation. Right? That is, the individual's making the decision, and he's being encouraged or not encouraged by some private institution, non-government. And the government's stepping as far back as it can. It's got general parameters, you know, your health and so on. But who are these people? These people are university students, state students, and there's 500,000 here, but who basically can work 20 hours a week if they want. So you could have 500,000 part-time students working here. In the vacation, they can work full-time. You could have 500,000 full-time workers. Another one is backpackers. That is, every piece of fruit that's grown in Australia can be picked by a backpacker who has decided to come to Australia. And then, you know, and can stay for a year and work certain times. Another group is the 457s, whereby the government, where the private sector employs a person, brings a person in. Now, all these temporary people can begin, if they want to, the process of becoming permanent. And that's incredibly complex for policy, right? Because to give you an example, actually, you might not know this, but every year you count the number of visitors to come to Australia and the number of visitors to leave, and every year there's 40,000 visitors who don't leave. So over 10 years there's almost 300,000 visitors, never left. A visitor visa is for 12 months, say. And the reason they don't leave is they come as a visitor and they're recorded, visitor come to Australia, and then they say, oh, I wouldn't mind being a student, and then they become a student, and then they have a student visa. So if they were left, they would leave as a student. So all of a sudden you'd have all these visitors coming, and they never sort of leave because they're something else. Except that when you look at the students, the number of students coming exceeds the number of students that leave by about 20, 30,000 every year. So we must have piles and piles of students piling up. But what they do is then they go to the next visa, right? Say a 457. So we have more 457s coming every year than leave. Right? And then what happens then? Then the 457s get a permanent visa, and that's where 60% of them come on shore. So you can see how complicated this process is and how interlinked it is. So if you block off one of these little, one of these things, like the backpackers, then they'll start squirming around it, find some other way through. So this means that we now have in Australia something that we didn't used to have, and that is a large temporary workforce of immigrants. And we're really quite special, because when you use temporary workforce of immigrants in most countries, everybody thinks about people off the bottom. You know, the, what is, I'm not sure what Trump calls them, Mexicans, I guess. every Mexican on the bottom, right? In Europe, I don't know, maybe you call them a Croatian or somebody. Well, that's old one. It's probably Afghanistan or something. But here, all these temporary people are different sort of people, right? They're on their way to become students up the rank. Well, if they're backpackers, they've given up becoming a lawyer at home for a while to pick fruit here. So we have about maybe a temporary workforce, maybe somewhere, it's hard to know, between 500,000 and 1 million workers. It's a lot of workers. Then, the next point I made about the 60% on shore, the GFC I made, and so on. Now, here's a fact to motivate you. Can you see the last line? That's an this is for all the anti-immigrant people in the audience. Take this away with you. This will help you enormously if you want to stop immigrants coming. It says, for those 25 to 34 years in the labour force survey who have a full-time job, I go back to 2006 and I say, how much has the number of people with a full-time job grown between 25 and 34 who were born in Australia
How much has it grown from people who were born overseas? So it's an increment, right?
3 out of 4
are born overseas. 3 out of 4 are born overseas. Never had any like this before.
Now, think of another thing.
Suppose, I have no evidence of what I'm about to say, but suppose that the overseas immigrant was more flexible in a labour market sense. You know, that if they're Chinese and they've got a degree, they still may work in a restaurant. Or if they're overseas born with an engineering degree, they may still work selling houses. They may not join unions. They may be prepared to take lower wages. Suppose they're more flexible. Everybody believes migrants are more flexible, by the way, one way or another. They move more, and so on. If all of a sudden, this is an incredible fact, if all of a sudden 3/4 of the jobs of these 25 to 34s are being directed towards a more flexible part of the labour market, maybe the most flexible policy, Howard never introduced, as it were, workplace choice, remember, all those policies are nothing compared to this. That is, policies about flexibility may not be anywhere near as big as the effect of bringing in workers who are flexible. That's a conjecture on my part. That's certainly true of some of these workers, I can tell you from my students, but whether, you know, it's generally true or not. So that's why this is a really big topic and worth doing. Okay, so I told you the old model was you were overseas, you apply for the visa, you become permanent. The new model is try before you buy. I've talked to you about that. We won't do that. Now, here's an interesting issue. Who determines who comes to Australia? If you're not John Howard or Tony, John Howard, who determines who comes to Australia? Well, the answer is not the government now. Because people are choosing to come as students, they're choosing to come as visitors, they're choosing to come as backpackers. The government sets the overall framework, but it's not choosing. What it's choosing is the permanent visas. Our permanent visas are 190,000. Now, suppose, and this is what actually happened, suppose you've got permanent visas of 100,000, and 100,000 people are coming, this is nice. All of a sudden you get all these temporary people. And then all of a sudden, suppose you've got 500,000 temporary people walking around the country, knocking on the door saying, I want a permanent visa, I want a permanent visa. What's going to happen is the government's going to up the permanent visas. Just response to the political pressure. If that happens, then the government is no longer really controlling the permanent visas. That is, the immigrants who in Italy and Hong Kong used to say, I want to come in, I want to come in. Stuff you. Right, you're in Hong Kong. People, who cares? But if you're here, running around, talking to people, pushing, shoving, trying to do, you have much more power. So the government, I think, has less power over the migration flow than it used to. It's not true it has no power, obviously, but it has less power than it used to. Now, I'm now going to talk about the 1 million people and the surprise. This is 1982 to today, and the blue dots are the natural increase in the population. You know, it's just, by the natural increase I mean, actually it's not a really good word now, I think, but it's often used. Natural increase just means the number of people born in Australia adding the number of people dying in Australia, leaving. So it's I guess it's the increase in the population if you just seal the border. Okay. Then the red dots are what are typically referred to as NOM, net overseas migrants. And this is, you count everybody that comes in a year, and you subtract everybody that leaves in a year, and the leftover is the addition to the population. And that's the red dots. And you can see by looking at this that when you have cycles and things, it's the red dots that go up. It's the red dots that go up and down, right? Because the red dots, anybody can come from overseas and leave, sort of thing. Right? It's not so easy to move the birth rate up and down, or the death rate up and down. So the natural increase is just a fairly constant thing. So all the swings and roundabouts are coming from the migrants. Now, in 2002, the intergenerational report projects 40 years hence, and the green little triangles are what they're predicting for migrants. And you can see, roughly speaking, they sort of predict the average of the red dots. And they predicted, say, they projected 90,000. Then the red dots dramatically increase, and then they project in 2010 about 120,000. And then today they're predicting about 220. But the important thing to notice is that if we believe this, then the mistake we would have made is a sum of all this area. It's the difference between the 90,000 every year and the number that came, and that's roughly a million. And notice that they basically are moving up. They learn, they move up, but they're always behind the game. Or they have always been behind the game. Dramatically so. Now, this is the IGR, which is coming out of the Treasury, but it's coming out of the ABS, because the ABS is projecting all this stuff as well. And it just means, it's not because they're silly, it's just that it's hard to predict. Once you open the borders and people can come and go, it's very, very hard to stop them coming, and it's very, very hard to stop them leaving. So what this shows is there's much more variability around than there used to be. Now, these are the same red dots as before. These are the people who are different between those who come and those that leave. And the blue dots, or the blue triangles, is the immigration program, the permanent places. And you can see the permanent places is really being following very closely the number of people who are choosing to come. Now, I think the way this causation runs is essentially the people choose to come, they put the pressure on, the visas go up. Not that the visas go up, therefore everybody decides to come. And so you can see that basically our visas have gone. I mean, it's quite remarkable that back here we were running visas at 80,000, and now we're running visas at 190,000, permanent visas at 190,000. So it's a big, big change. Now, we hear a lot about the ageing of the population, and so one of the things that's of interest is that when the migrants come, they don't represent the whole population distribution. You know, if you've got 10% of people in Australia at 90 years of age, you don't get 10% of migrants coming at 90 years of age. Likewise, you have lots of two-year-olds, you don't get lots of two-year-olds. The migrants are very, very focused in the workforce age groups when they arrive. So the impact of this 1 million is going to be focused on the workforce contribution. So even though it's a million people, the impact on the workforce is going to be bigger, because the proportion of the group coming to work is going to be bigger. So the blue line here is the population growth for Australia, 15 to 64. Australian born, see how sort of fairly stable it is. But you can see that here's basically 2005, here's the GFC. You can see all the big blowout in the population of our working force is coming from the migrants. Because the red is the total, the blue is the Australian, the gap is the migrants. To make it clearer, look at this. This is a terrific picture, really. It says the following, that what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the number of Australians today between 15 and 64 in the population, and I'm going to compare them to 5 years ago. So I'm going to get a 5-year increase. And I'm going to take the migrants, 15, 64 today, and compare them to 5 years ago. And I'm going to do this for every year since 96. So it's like a growth rate, but it's a 5-year growth rate. So just to smooth out the ups and downs. So if this was the world, and it was going to stay this way, this would say that in Australia, over 5 years, you pick up 400,000 Australian born, you pick up 200,000 migrants. Basically, as time goes by, the migrants will make up roughly a third of Australia. 200 migrants, 400 Australian, 206. Okay. Then look what's happened at the end. The last decade, the last 5 or 6 years, the growth in the workforce between 15 and 64 is half migrants, half locals. If that were to go forever, the migrant fraction was over 50%. This shows you this point that I was talking about, you know, about the new group with the flexibility. Just and look how fast. Here's the 2005. People projected this, and that's what we're going. Right? Now, I think that this must have a really big effect on what's been going on in Australia, and that's what I'm trying to sort of get towards, and it'll get clearer as time goes by. So here it is, even more dramatic. This is 15 to 44s. Because, you know, again, the migrants tend to come younger, right? They come at 25, 30, 35. This is an amazing picture because it says, if you're running a firm and you say, give me a 15 to 44, give me a 15 to 44, I want to take someone, train them for life sort of thing, right? Then, back here, you have a choice of about 180,000 local born, 180,000 immigrants, right? No immigrants, rather. This is Australian, that's the total, right? Back here, at the beginning, basically hardly any immigrants are coming in say, it's mainly all locals. And then all of a sudden, hit about 2005, up goes the overseas born, the gap between the two men. Now, doing the thing again on the 5-year growth, you can see the red line, which is the overseas born, we're now running well ahead of the local born. Take the population 15 to 44, look which is growing. Most of the growth is coming from the migrants, not the locals. So if we had a world where I put the migrants back to where they used to be, growth rate, then the whole labour market would be quite different. You're essentially currently you'd be losing 60% of the workers, you know, in safety your current. The whole housing market would be different. Such a big deal. Okay. Now, all I've been talking about is the population, and I've divided the population up into two groups: overseas born and Australian born. I'm now, just to wind up in time, I'm going to show you some full-time job figures. Now, I'm going to begin at the total. So, first of all, I'm going to show you the additional full-time employment in Australia, and the green line is going to be Australian-born. So I'm going to go back to here, and I'm going to take the number of full-time workers in 91, and then just follow what's happened and take the difference. So, you know, if the employment's the same as it was at 91, the green line would just run along zero. There'd be no change. It's going to be focusing on the change. Right? So you can see additional full-time employment for Australian-born. Everything's sort of chuffing along here. And then it stops. This is reiterating what I said before. Not only are the migrants providing a lot of the population growth, there's been no growth in Australian-born full-time employed for almost the last decade. The blue line is adding the migrants on. So the blue line is the total, and you can see that all the job growth from about here, back down here, the job growth is 2. From here, the locals have stopped. So from here onwards, it's all foreign-born. So at the margin, the labour market, from a full-time perspective, is depending increasingly on migrants. Okay, now I'm going to go back to these 15 to 44s because that's the most dramatic picture. I've switched to 10 years, I'm sorry about that, I just got my pictures mixed up, but it doesn't matter if it's 10 or 5. I go back here and I go 10 years forward and say, what's the growth over the 10 years? And then just move it forward step by step. So it's a 10-year average.
So instead of finding a quarterly average or annual average, it's a 10-year one. The blue line is full-time employment for Australian-born. And if you look at the end, there's no growth for 10 years. See? This is zero. No growth. The red line is the immigrants, overseas people. All the growth since about, taking this 10-year window, all the growth for the last 5 or 6 years, going back 10 years, all of it has come from the immigrants. Big biggies. Okay? Now, the question then becomes, I've done the population growth and I've shown you how big the immigrant fraction is. I've done the full-time employment and shown you how big that is. Hardly any growth at all in the 15 to 44s. Now, we should try and figure out how much of this has been generated by just more and more immigrants here, and how much has been generated by the way in which they take full-time jobs compared to others. You know, the ratio. For example, if the full-timers were 80% full-time and the immigrants were 80% full-time, then whatever we've been observing would all be generated by the population shifts. But if the immigrants were 80% full-time and the locals were 60, or it had shifted, some of it would be generated by that. So I'm now going to show you the employment ratios. So the blue line is the Australian-born, 15 to 40. I take the number who work full-time and divide it by their population. And you can see that basically, and this is for men and women, right? So you can see that even though lots of people are going to university and staying at school longer, basically what's been happening for this age group of Australians, it used to be roughly 59% work full-time, it's been rising to at least about 66. All that increase is basically being generated by the women starting to work full time. Then, from about 2007, the fraction of this age group working has been falling. The red line underneath is the immigrants, and they always have lower employment rates, partly because so many of them are not in the labour market full time, they're students. So. Or their backpack working part-time. So they're not all working full-time. So they're lower. But notice that since about, the last 8 or 9 years, the immigrant proportion working full-time has been constant. That means all the growth in their employment is coming from the size of that group, not from their employment, changing employment. But for the locals, the employment proportion has been falling. So there is a little bit of substitution between switching from the blue line to the red line for one reason or another. I'm not going to say why. There's a little bit of that going on, but mostly it's being generated by the population shifts. Okay. Now, I think I've taken half an hour or so, I'll just wind up very, very quickly. And I'm saying it's possible, and I haven't quite figured out an easy way to do this, but it's possible that this huge increase of 1 million people is having just as strong effect on the economy as the migrant itself. It's possible. Because 1 million people is a lot of people. You know, I start giving them houses, I start giving them accommodation one sort or another, I start giving them furniture, clothes, all those sorts of things. 1 million people is a lot. It's about 5% of the population. The other thing that's happened, which is quite interesting, is how successful to date this huge increase of people has been using standard sort of criteria. That is, if you look, say, the average wage of these workers, which I haven't shown you today, compared to the average wage of the locals, in almost every country that you look at, the average wage of the immigrants has been falling. And if you look at the temporary one, it's fallen dramatically compared to the locals. Here, you can't see anything dramatic.
whether they're falling or not falling, I'm not sure, but whatever it is, it's not big biggies. So the quality of these people is quite different in that sense. So it's been an incredibly successful thing. Now, just to talk about some of the policy things very, very quickly, and that is, the first thing to know is if you believe, like I do, that this huge increase in immigration had a big positive effect on the economy in terms of the extra houses and all this sort of stuff, you've got to ask the question whether we can continue to do this. And my guess is the next decade we won't be surprised by extra million people. So if we can't continue to do this, that would be a natural break in some sense. Or break, I mean, B-R-A-K. But if you want to reverse it, suppose it reverses, then if you believe in this big impact on the upswing, then roughly speaking, you're going to get something like that on the downswing. So I think Australia is now more vulnerable, as it were, to the effects of ups and downs in the migrants than it used to be. Because the potential for going ups and downs is bigger than it used to be. Because people are choosing to come or not come. Where previously it was mainly, you know, there was this excess supply, the visa numbers were down, and that sort of kept things really stable. So I think there's more variation around. I think it had implications for important things like infrastructure, which is obvious, and housing. I think I'll leave it at that.
Questions? Where do we start?
Well, I've just got a few questions about the greater likelihood of immigrants wanting to work full-time compared to Australians, Australian-born. Is there a much greater likelihood of them wanting to do full-time work, and that you've got the female participation story as well in Australia, that they're more likely to work part-time?
This is the picture of immigrants, and the red line is the immigrants working full-time, the blue line is Australian-born. Immigrants work less full-time. I can break this up to men and women. You get the same relationship roughly for men and women. So immigrant women are mainly a bit lower than local women in this age group, mainly to do with the education process. You can follow them through time and see what happens. I haven't done, but let me just show you, I'll show you one picture which you might be interested in. That's too complicated. But anyway, what's basically happened is the immigrant share of the part-time workforce has gone up dramatically. The main growth in immigrant employment, like the economy in general, has been into the part-time area. And that, I think, is primarily a product of the temporary nature, you know, the temporary workers coming in. The temporary workers coming in tend overwhelmingly to be part-time because they're university students working part-time. They're backpackers, perhaps working part-time. Right? The only exception is the 457 group. So lots and lots of part-time workers here as well. I don't have time to tell you exactly how the mixture has gone through time, but the part-time share is going up dramatically. How many actually want what they've got, I've never looked at. But we can. You know, I can't tell you, the gap between what they want and what they're getting. The unemployment rate is very, very low amongst immigrants. By the unemployment rate, I mean the unemployment rate that they tell you. And some of that is because, I guess, they're not entitled to unemployment benefits, and so maybe that affects what they say. But their spoken unemployment rate is very low. It's roughly the same as the locals. And it never used to be under the old system, it used to be much higher.
It's just interesting that 15 to 44 is showing the growth rate amongst Australian-born dropping so significantly.
Yes.
What's causing that? I mean, is that the part-time story? Is that the female part-time employment story sort of swamping growth, you know?
Yeah. I can't give you a definitive answer at this point.
Yeah.
But what is true, which is interesting, is that roughly half the jobs created in Australia over, say, a decade are part-time. And roughly half are full-time. So, but I think that's one of the big facts that we don't really think about, that at the margin, Australia has as many, at the margin, growth part-time workers as it has full-time workers. So if you were thinking about individuals and their relationship to work and all that sort of stuff, what's really interesting in Australia is that at the margin, half of them are part-timers. And yet when we talk about work, overwhelmingly, we focus on the full-timers. You know, could we talk about, you know, oh, full-timers need leave conditions, or full-timers, we compare wage equality between men and women on a full-time basis. Now, a lot of our looking at the labour market in Australia is still inherited from the past on its overemphasis of full-time. One of the reasons why I think we overemphasise it is that most of the people who are interested in the data are themselves full-time workers. And, you know, when you do this stuff, you always respond to the bits that relate to you, you know. So, you know, if I were to get up for you and say, in this audience, and say, Australia leads the world, we're the most successful country in the world because we've had so many part-time job growth, people would sort of look at you a bit odd. Right? But, you know, I think that's probably true. And it's just the lag. And so, one of the things that annoys me a little bit about the women's movement, for example, increasingly it's focused on full-time, where, you know, the bulk and the growth is all part-time. So if you start off with a woman, rather, you know, did you start off with the part-time workers? Because that's where they were. Increasing, and not diminishing much. No, not diminishing.
Bob, you just teasingly at the end there talked about the impact on population ageing. I guess the standard view is that dealing with ageing by taking in more migrants is a bit of a Ponzi scheme game, because migrants come in only a decade younger than the average and then end up getting older.
Yeah.
Do you share that view, or do you think there's something interesting
to say? No. Okay. I'll tell you why. I'll offer you a Ponzi scheme, right? You and I. I guarantee you're going to make money in the first 10 years. Or 20 years. Do you want to take it? Oh, but by the way, after 80 years, you're not going to make any money, because then the migrants are going to look like the locals, right? So I think historically that was a con. You know, the way it was set up is exactly what you said, that the migrants look like the rest of us, in the sense they're going to live the same way, blah, blah. So you take one, anything you gain is going to be temporary, because they're going to get old, end of story. But in fact, they do make a contribution in the short run. And the short run is not 1 year, but it's a decade or two. But it's not enough. I mean, I started to do some calculations. It's not enough to offset the aging thing. According to my sort of calculations, it's sort of slowed. This is not quotable. It's sort of stopped the aging thing for a while. But, you know, eventually the ageing thing comes back again. Because the ageing, the way to think about this ageing thing, and I just might just say this because I think it's an important point. When you think about ageing, you've got to think about two things. So, and you've got to keep them separate. One part is the change in life expectancy. You know, how we're all going to live longer. And then that's one part. And that's going to cost you money a bit, you know. And the other part is the ageing that's generated by the particular distribution of people's age groups. Right? That is, you know, if you have a lot of 60 to 65 year olds today and no 20 to 24 year olds, all of a sudden you've got an aging problem as they flip over. So the migration impacts on that phenomenon, not on the first one. And that's been mixed up in a lot of the debate. But it's not enough to offset it. But it does make a big contribution. Now, the other way of looking at it is to think about it in tax terms, which I haven't done. But because because they're in this concentrated age group, the tax contribution is pretty substantial. Because, you know, while they work a little bit less in the locals, there's the age contribution helps them a lot.
How much of this do you think is cyclical in terms of we've just gone through this massive mining boom and that's sucked in a lot of labour from overseas? What potential do you think is there for this unwind as Australia potentially becomes a less attractive
destination? Big question. That's right, because some of the migrants in the last 10 or so years were pushed here, you know, and you can think of that as cyclical. And you can see that if you look at the Irish data, all of a sudden we started to get Irish migrants, which have now more or less stopped, but not big numbers. So some of them are pushed. I think a lot of it, well, when you look at who's moving these numbers around, it tends to be people of Chinese ethnicity and increasingly Indians. And then the question becomes, will those two groups keep wanting to come at the same sort of rates? And will they want to be educated here at the same sort of rates? I think, and this is purely conjecture, I think the answer to that will be yes. So that even though the income levels in China have risen dramatically compared to Australia, so the gains from coming, if you're Chinese, are much less than they used to be in financial terms, I think there are so many Chinese who never even thought about coming, you know, that we'll still keep going, but I don't know. The Indians are trickier, but Indians have traditionally not come to Australia. Basically, you know, they've been very Eurocentric, UK-centric in particular. Life's getting tough in Europe, so I don't know. But I think that's absolutely essential because historically the migrant flow's gone up and down with the cycle in Australia. And the cycle in Australia has been pretty good, certainly relative to everybody else.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
You talked about the sort of impact of that extra unanticipated million people on infrastructure in the future. Have you got any sense of how much of an underspend there might already be?
How much of a...
How much did we fail to spend on infrastructure and so on? What that might be contributing?
I've started to look at housing. And, like this morning... and the thing that's sort of interesting about housing, as far as I can see, which is sort of what you might expect, that is that suppose you think of this as no temporary migrants to 2005, then they all start coming, then that it takes a while. The housing thing looks to me as though it's pretty lagged, like 5 or 6 or 7 years, right? But now I think this kick up, you can now see this big kick up in housing. I think that's coming from the accumulated sum of all these migrants. Now, the way I think about it myself, and I think this is not a bad analogy when you look at housing and people, is there's a lot of squeezability. You know, like, if the housing stock's not growing fast enough, then the density per house just goes up a little bit. And the way it goes up is, you know, I stay with my mum a little bit longer instead of sharing a flat with 4 people, I share it with 5. You know, there's a lot of that sort of stuff which carries you up and down over the cycle. But eventually, you go back to the norm. And I think it's only the last 3 or 4 years that we're starting to move closer to a normal balance. But we should do the same for infrastructure. Because it turns out, on the immigration debate, you know, that the infrastructure provision is increasingly one of the things that people oppose against immigrants. In the old days, they used to oppose immigrants. No, I'm making this up, but basically, I think this is sort of like, used to oppose immigrants because you didn't like them. Whereas now, you know, you tend to complain it's taking so long to get to work. You know, the road. You know, the Sydney, the Bob Carr view. The Bob Carr view of the world is immigrants are fine provided they're not in Sydney, you know, because it just makes life harder for me to get around Sydney. And I think that's a really important point because living in Canberra, I'm quite... You know, the immigrants all just brought me positive things in Canberra, basically, because it hasn't impacted that much on my ability to get around, but it's impacted a lot on the services I can buy.
Last question, probably.
Thanks, Bob. Treasury look at this, you know, three Ps.
Yes.
The population, participation, and productivity. And there's, I think there's a general consensus that productivity, you know, sort of is most of the game there. Do you think that with this type of decade that we've seen, that perhaps this will shift some views around, say, the importance of population?
Yeah, I do.
Also the impact that this has had on labour participation, which is what you're showing on there. Yeah.
I think the idea that productivity is most of the game stems from the focus on what we're really interested in is the income per head. Mm-hmm. When it's the productivity that delivers the income per head, as it were. As I go to work, I get produced twice as many shoes, I get twice the pay. But from the macro perspective, I think over the last decade, the productivity is not really the big issue at all. From the macro, that's how the economy's growing, what it's doing, I think the population is right up front. So I would sort of go population first, participation second, and productivity third. From that perspective. If I want to talk about income per head, then it's really quite tricky whether the migrants increase the average income per head or reduce. That's so much harder. And for that thing, you re-rank them again. So you just have to be careful about what question you're putting in mind when you think about allocating the shift, but the importance across those four.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're out of time, and I promise to have it all wrapped up by 1:30. Thank you all very much for coming, and... thank you very much for that fascinating talk. Please join me in thanking Professor Gregory.